It's time to take the quiz.
5 questions, 5 minutes a day, 5 days a week.
Take the quiz every weekday at thequiz.fox and then listen to the quiz podcast to find out how you did.
Play, share, and of course, listen to the quiz at thequiz.fox.
I'm Emily Campagno, and this is the Fox True Crime Podcast. Cracking a case can be a difficult feat, especially when it involves a false allegation. Unfortunately, false allegations are a relatively common occurrence within the criminal justice system. The contexts and reasonings behind false allegations vary from case to case, yet the harm they cause is universal. So how are false allegations detected? How are they prosecuted? And what impact do they have on society? Dr. Park Dietz is a forensic psychiatrist with an illustrious career that involved testimonies and consultations in various high-profile cases. He joins me today to discuss the prevalence of such allegations, why they were created, and the impact they have on the pursuit of truth. Dr. Dietz, how frequently do you see false allegations come up during your work with the justice system?
I run into them several times a year. But that's in part because many cases flow through me to my associates. So I have a bird's eye view on lots of different cases. It's hard to give a real estimate of how many, because sometimes they are buried among lots of true cases. For example, we have cases in which there are 1,000 plaintiffs suing for events that happened 30 or 40 years ago. And we may not be able to examine many of them before the cases settle. And buried within those large numbers is an unknown number of people who simply sued hoping for money, even though nothing happened to them.
Given that, or notwithstanding that, are there any commonalities? Are there any trends that have stuck out to you, even in that bird's eye view of them all, or one or two that were notable to you for a reason that remains interesting to you to this day?
Sure. Well, the ones that are clearly false allegations are ones where there's been a thorough investigation and we can prove what did or didn't happen. That's not always the case. The first one that really seemed to me dramatic and unforgettable was the Tawana Brawley case, in which a young woman was found in what seemed a dazed state with writing on her body and disheveled, was taken to an emergency room where her father approached her, and she pointed to a uniformed police officer. This quickly grew into an allegation that law enforcement personnel had done this to her, and in jumped some of the people who've made their careers on claims of racism, including Al Sharpton, and supported the claim that this was law enforcement's doing. Well, a giant investigation later called that narrative into question. I testified before a grand jury investigating the allegations and pointed out the characteristics of this event consistent with false allegations that had been studied by the FBI, with whom I was studying this at the time. And I think eventually it became clear to everyone that she had done this to herself for personal reasons.
And how are those false reports and allegations prosecuted?
Well, unfortunately, many of them do not get prosecuted. But when they do, the punishments range from quite minor to fairly severe. I'd say the vast majority of proved false allegations result in little or no punishment, which is a problem because they do immense harm. Not only are the people who are falsely accused made to suffer, often going to great expense sometimes losing custody of their children or losing careers. But also, this diverts investigative resources from law enforcement and can get a lot of people spinning their wheels, all because of what someone thought was a good idea at the time or mere mischief.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, for example, obviously the Jesse Smollett case out of Chicago, where as part of his subsequent prosecution for filing false police reports, which were felonies under that jurisdiction, he was also tasked with paying back that amount of resources that had been expended due to his false allegations. And in California, for example, filing a false police report falls under the crime against the public category. It sort of derives from society's feelings that it harms everyone when you are untruthful about a crime occurring. Can you help explain, as a forensic psychiatrist, maybe some of the mental reasons as to why people make these false accounts? You've touched on a few things, but, you know, from a layperson's point of view, I just think about attention seeking and selfishness and people who might think they have no other way out. But is there a common thread that you've identified?
Well, there are a number of them. So first of all, we have to look at the context. There are a few areas that have been carefully studied and many others that have not. There's a lot of research about false allegations of child sexual abuse. There's a lot of research about false allegations of rape. There's some research about false allegations of sexual harassment. But most of the other categories have not had quantitative studies done. If we look at the false allegations of child sexual abuse, one of the contexts is in child custody disputes. And often the story is that a mother who's disadvantaged in various ways in the court system tries to bolster her case for custody by implying that the father has molested the child, and may actually coach the child into how to falsely report sexual abuse. This can be done in a variety of ways. And the mother may not explicitly tell the child to lie about it, but ask a series of leading questions to which children are very susceptible, and eventually gets a narrative that, when told to a child abuse worker, sounds like dad molested the kid. And here we have a system in which protection of the child is paramount. And so the father may lose the ability to have contact with the child during the pendency of a custody dispute. Another common phenomenon is for an individual who's got some personal dilemma, failing to fulfill an obligation or not being able to get what they want, and sees a false allegation of sexual assault or something else as the solution to their problem. And so in order to solve their problem, they make this claim. I'll give you a couple examples. One is a woman who falsely claimed she had been raped in order to get her husband returned to the U.S. from a military deployment overseas. All she wanted is to be with her husband again, but she accused someone and caused great harm by making this claim. In other cases, claims have been made because someone was stood up by their boyfriend or their husband and wanted to get his attention and have him solicitous and supportive, and making a false claim seemed a pathway to do that. But the pseudo victim was giving no thought to what this did to other people or to the system. And the reasons people do this are quite variable, but primarily can be summarized as trying to solve a personal dilemma without regard to how much havoc they wreak in achieving their ends.
right? Almost a short-sighted, you exchange long-term significant severe consequences for sort of a short-term goal or a short-term satiation.
Exactly. Another context in which we see false allegations is in looking at threats on behalf of corporations or institutions, where we run into a few cases a year in which people have sent themselves threatening communications or have vandalized their own property in order to gain the advantage of added attention and nurturance, or to avoid having to fulfill responsibilities. There's some hallmarks of these kinds of cases, and we counsel clients to consult us if they suspect this at all, because how to interview someone who's made a false allegation has some unique characteristics. We have to use a face-saving method in order to get the truth out of people who do this.
We're going to take a quick break. More from our guest after this.
Listen to the all-new Brett Baer podcast featuring Common Ground, in-depth talks with lawmakers from opposite sides of the aisle, along with all your Brett Baer favorites like his all-star panel and much more. Available now at foxnewspodcasts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
On that note, we interviewed the prosecutor in the Susan Smith case from South Carolina. And as you recall, Susan Smith was convicted of murdering her own two children. And,
yes.
But initially had reported to police and the public that she had been carjacked. And she specifically articulated that an African-American male had carjacked her and drove off with her two children strapped inside. Now, later she confessed to, and it was determined that she herself had simply driven the vehicle off the boat ramp into a lake while her children were strapped inside their car seats, murdering them. What are your thoughts, or your professional thoughts, on that very racially charged, frankly, but that element of that false report that could have had a very significant effect on community relations at the time?
Well, two issues. First, about the Susan Smith case in particular. I first heard of it from one of the investigating agents of the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, who, upon observing the first interview of Susan Smith, correctly recognized that this is a false allegation. And he was having trouble getting others in authority to understand that that's what it was and to accept that truth. They were falling for her story. And then I was hired by the prosecution to look into it further. Now, in that instance, I think her motive seems to have been to shed her children, who were excess baggage, at a time when she was hoping to attract the romantic attention of another man besides her husband. And if that's true, that was actually her motive, it would be one of the more horrific motives ever for a false allegation, to kill your own children for that purpose. Now, the fact that she accused African Americans is one of a number of examples of false allegations that seek to play on racial, ethnic, gender, or political hatred. And in my opinion, that kind of false allegation is the most destructive to social cohesion, and it has the greatest potential to foster intolerance.
What struck out to me to that point was the prosecutor saying that he remembered, was it one of the local reporters, I think, interviewing different community members and speaking with an African-American female member of the community who said, he brought up this point that Susan Smith had made this distinction of identifying falsely the color of someone's skin. And the woman replied, Susan Smith said that, the community didn't. And I think a beautiful example of being able to parse out accountability from one person's behavior and decisions do not reflect an entire community.
It is a great example. Unfortunately, many people can't parse things quite that well.
That's true, unfortunately. And while we're on this, because you have had such a just incredibly illustrious career, really just an incredible career, sir. And we've covered a lot of cases that you've participated in, many notable ones, the assassination attempt of Ronald Reagan, Joker Tsarnaev, the Boston Marathon bomber Polly Klass, her kidnapping and murder, Susan Smith, as we just referenced, Jeffrey Dahmer, the DC snipers. Out of any of those, are there thoughts that you can share with the listeners? Was there one you found particularly challenging or particularly illuminating, one that has stuck with you since then of those?
You know what creates a challenge in evaluating cases like these is when the lawyers get in the way of finding the truth. I have always seen the role of forensic evaluators as being trying to get to the truth of what's occurred. And the rules that come into play in the legal system are not designed to find the truth. For example, something we deal with regularly is that we believe that videotaping examinations of criminal defendants is the most important thing that can be done to preserve the evidence, to assure transparency, and to give everyone the opportunity to see if we as interviewers have manipulated the person, have crossed boundaries in some way, have done something inappropriate, have asked leading or suggestive questions. And yet we're constantly encountering motions filed with the court to prevent videotaping as too intrusive or as supposedly interfering with the defendant's rights. This happens behind the scenes and the public doesn't hear about it, but it's frustrating to try to get to the truth when there are barriers to that.
Can you share, has there been a specific example of that you're at liberty to share a little bit more of?
Oh, it happens all the time, and for varying reasons. For example, I sought to videotape my evaluation of Dylann Roof, whom I interviewed at length. Here, the court allowed it. However, Dylann Roof said he wouldn't talk to me if I were videotaping, so there was no video. The case of Robert Bowers, who did the Tree of Life synagogue shooting, I again asked to be able to videotape. That issue was litigated, and the court declined to allow videotaping because the defense objected to it.
This is sort of a philosophical question, but, you know, do you subscribe to the overarching concept that essentially we sacrifice, you know, as we talk about short-term and long-term goals, that we sacrifice, sort of short-term interests or detailed interests for the larger notion of the sanctity of the criminal justice system, i.e. that, you know, motions are granted and denied all the time. And if procedure is in any way interfered with, you know, that outweighs like the sanctity of the process outweighs maybe the probative value of a piece of evidence, that like the end of the day, we have to have this faith in the system. And that is worth everything, including minor pieces of evidence or potentially major pieces of evidence. Because I feel personally, while that makes sense conceptually, in practicality, it almost always fails. Because in practicality, it just makes cases heartbreaking. And sometimes it makes the resolution heartbreaking and not just by any means.
I suppose how one evaluates each of these depends on one's values. And while I recognize that trying to preserve a system of law and the rights of the accused has paramount importance, what I can say is that it does not aid in the search for truth and it does not always aid in the search for justice.
And then just as a final question, sir, for those who aren't familiar, can you just describe what exactly is forensic psychiatry?
It's usually defined as the application of the principles and practice of psychiatry for purposes of law or to settle legal disputes. A clinical psychiatrist is listening to patients, gathering a few records, maybe talking to a spouse, and relying on what the patient says and trying to help the patient get better. It doesn't matter if what the patient says is true or not. It matters that one be able to help the patient to the best of one's ability. In forensic psychiatry, in contrast, we know that many people are going to lie to us in whole or in part. And so we rely to a large extent on investigative information developed by law enforcement or by lawyers. And we're skeptical of what is told to us by the people we're evaluating, whether they're civil plaintiffs or criminal defendants. And we have to take a much deeper dive into the person's entire life and see what can be corroborated or refuted about what the individual tells us. So it's a very detail-oriented enterprise designed, in my view, to get to the truth. Some of my colleagues would say that following the law and the process that the law wants is all that matters. And their concern is not with the truth, but in trying to fit into the legal system in a helpful way. I don't approach it that way. To me, truth is what it's all about. Not that we can ever truly find all of it, but we get as close as we can.
Doctor, it was such an honor to have you here with us today. Really, you are such a wealth of information and experience, and I really enjoy listening to you. Thank you so much, Dr. Dietz, for joining us today and for your service to so many. We are so grateful. Thank you.
Thanks for inviting me.
To hear more stories like this, you can listen to our past episodes on the Fox True Crime Podcast. Go to foxnewspodcast.com or wherever you download podcasts to listen and subscribe. Listen ad-free with a Fox News Podcast Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts, and Amazon Prime members can listen to the show ad-free on the Amazon Music app. If you have a story or topic you want to hear on the show, we'd love to hear from you. Send us an email at truecrimepodcast@fox.com.
The Fox News Rundown, a contrast of perspectives you won't hear anywhere else. Your daily dose of news twice a day, featuring insight from top newsmakers, reporters, and Fox News contributors. Listen and subscribe now by going to foxnewspodcasts.com.